Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of 3-4-2 Productions. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. Steve, happy Monday. How you doing, sir?
Yo, what up? Hi.
Yo, what up? You reckon?
Dunker Nation, let's ride. Like, subscribe, comment. Let's talk hoop.
Let's talk hoop. We ain't even hooping it up this week. That's crazy. That is crazy. What's happened to the brand? The Dunker Spot needs the all-star break. That is wild. Anyway, we are here to talk some hoop. Fun slate of games over the weekend. On our last episode, the Thursday episode for the audio-only listeners, we talked through virtually every trade that happened on trade deadline day, gave our early thoughts about what the fits were going to look like. And, you know, I guess Thursday ended up being fly to your new city, get the physicals, etc. So over the weekend, we got some of the debuts. So we want to talk through a lot of those, if not all of those. We get early thoughts on what the fit actually looks like. Obviously, it's day one or game two, in the case like Buddy Hield. We got a couple in over the weekend. So things will evolve. Players will get more comfortable. Usage will expand, etc., etc. But wanted to get some early thoughts on some of those takeaways. We got some notable free agency news in the NBA side. We'll talk through some of that as well. Cap things off with some W news. We're going to have some fun. Let's talk about some of these debuts. Let's start with the Dallas Mavericks, who quiet as kept. Winners of four of their last five. Four-game winning streak. A massive win over the Oklahoma City Thunder on Saturday. A 146-111 win. Daniel Gafford and PJ Washington both making their debuts. Pretty productive for both of them, I would say. 19 points, 9 rebounds, a block in 17 minutes for Daniel Gafford. And PJ Washington with 14 points, 5 rebounds, and a steal of his own. Steve, what were some of your early takeaways from the Gafford and Washington debuts in Dallas?
I mean, I had a few. I think the biggest thing for me was just when the trades happened, Daniel Gafford stood out right away because of his ability to roll, rebound, defend, having another lob threat for Luka, having someone who can do what Lively also does. So there's just continuous flow for the Mavericks was huge. PJ Washington's versatility stood out to me when the trade happened and how they would use him was big. I think overall, just taking even a bigger picture look at it, just how important fit, opportunity, and context is and what a team needs from you and how that can be impactful in a different setting. I know for a lot of folks, the trade deadline may not have had some of that signature sizzle, but sometimes you go to a restaurant, you order fajitas, and you gotta go to the bathroom and you miss the sizzle. But guess what? You still got fajitas. And I think Dallas ended up doing the loudest thing. What you got, Nikias?
Two things. One, wow, are we getting the Steve Hungry Pod? Two, to the trade deadline complaints about not getting the big splash. This is a season in which we have seen James Harden switch teams. It's not like we haven't had action this year. And like on the Miami side, like why didn't Miami do anything at the deadline? Like you just got Terry Rozier like 2 weeks ago. It's not like we haven't had big moves, and we'll talk about some others throughout the pod, but that complaint, like it's there. And I look at it and it's just like, what are we expecting exactly? Especially once you factor in how the new CBA will play into things, second apron teams, et cetera, not being able to aggregate things the way that you might want to, keeping the books in order and all that good stuff. I don't know what the expectation was. Like Donovan Mitchell wasn't being moved. Cat or Gobert wasn't being moved. Trey wasn't going to be moved. The DeJounte Murray noise quieted as the deadline approached. Like, why were people up in arms about that? But I'm sorry. That was just a quick one.
No, we're good. I'm feeling good. So I don't know if we have any gamers out there. I'm old and washed, but like every time I unlock a Nikias rate about something, it feels like the Xbox achievement just flashes right there. And I did it. Progress. I think going back to Dallas, with Gafford, you saw the fit right away in his debut. You saw what he could do right away. I think what really opened my eyes before the game was hearing that PJ Washington was so excited when he heard he got traded to Dallas that he ran out of a restaurant.
Like, is that why he missed the fajitas?
Do you know how excited you have to be to leave food? Like, maybe it's just me. But I'm picturing this man trying to like go into his car to attempt his longest yeah boy ever. I don't know what to tell you. That matters. You could see the excitement they had on the court and just how important it is when you switch to a more competitive environment. That can enhance some of the little things. Some of the rotations are stronger. Some of the closeouts are stronger. How many times have you seen Daniel Gafford run someone off a three-point line this year?
A handful of times, but not in the way that you would want him to.
How many times have you seen PJ Washington defend another team's best player?
I don't want to talk about it.
We saw both of those in this one. You could see the excitement from Washington bounce around on defense, closing out shooters. They wanted to be there. I think seeing Daniel Gafford in a drop and calling out a late switch and switching on multiple drives, that's a fit for Dallas. That enhances their team. You look at Dallas, you go to the middle of the first quarter. They've got Kyrie out there with Luka, with Tim Hardaway Jr., with PJ Washington, with Daniel Gafford. Not a bad unit to flow into. And the biggest part for me is those two guys can enhance what Dallas has already done and try and help elevate them with what they do. Back to Gafford, Luka gets a post up. First possession for Gafford offensively. OKC is trying to show help from the baseline. Gafford sees Williams go. And he immediately just goes and finds Isaiah Joe. Luka throws a lob right away. Out of a timeout, they run a lob play for PJ Washington. Use him as a screener. Tim Hardaway back screens for him. Luka throws another lob. It was very funny to watch the camera pan to Luka after both of those lobs. That man seemed very happy and excited for those debuts.
I was just going to say, it's like the lively thing all over again. Throws the ball high up in the air. And it's like, oh, wait, y'all can go get these. This is neat.
It plays a role, plays a factor. In the debut game, my eyes were just on the little things with PJ Washington and how would they fit with what Dallas needs. I think that's a very specific thing that people have to understand. Playing next to Luka, you have to be able to space the floor. You're also going to have to hit certain notes for it to work in Dallas. Luka's going to force help in pick and roll, no matter what the scheme is. You want to do drop, you want to do two on the ball. You want to be at the level. He's going to make the defense shift and rotate. If you're spaced, hey, can you knock down enough shots to make the defense pay? Can you mix in driving closeouts to keep the advantage for Dallas? I thought PJ Washington passed that part of the test, especially if you go to the sequence in the third quarter. Luka's coming off a screen from Daniel Gafford. The defense helps on that roll. It's a skip pass to Washington for a three. Next time down, it's Tim Hardaway Jr. pushing in transition. Another Gafford screen, another roll. This time PJ gets it, catches, drives, and finishes. That's key for me. And now you can kind of widen everything out. But if he can do that, the rest of what he's done or what he can do would pop. What did you think about PJ's debut?
I enjoyed both PJ and Daniel Gafford in this one. It's like, as we talked about on the pod, like, these are skill sets that could pop in Dallas. And honestly, my first thought watching it live, and like, we had it up in the watch party, you want to join us for those. But one of my early thoughts was like, very basic thing, but man, Luka makes their life so much easier. Because I was thinking about like just the way that PJ was used or the way that Daniel Gafford was used. It's like, it's not like Dallas is running elaborate stuff that we didn't see at least semblances of in Washington and in Charlotte. It's a little bit different when Luka is the one running action versus even LaMelo when he was healthy. Or you trickle on down when some of the guard injuries hit in Charlotte. It's a little bit different when Luka's running the helm versus a Tyus Jones or Jordan Poole, with all due respect. And so, like, even to the back screen play for PJ Washington to get the early lob, how quickly Luka threw that pass, he didn't think about it. Like, oh, no, that's good contact from Tim Hardaway Jr. This is PJ Washington against a smaller OKC guard. I am just tossing this up. I trust you already. Go get that. And even with some of the lobs of Daniel Gafford, it's just like, oh, Luka is an incredible passer. Again, we've talked about the Derrick Lively fit already. That's some of the best screens I've seen from Daniel Gafford this year.
Well, the big fella was rewarded.
He sure was.
Yeah, I'm going to make sure your guy has to go over. I'm going to roll hard because I know, hey, either I'm getting it or the defense is going to help. It's going to open something else up.
Yeah, so it was just fun just watching, like, again, very dull analysis to this portion. Like, oh, Luka just helps. Like, there are just going to be windows that are open that those two may not be used to having or having the ability to exploit in that way. And so I think even that should add another layer of energy. Better screens, harder cuts. The lifts are going to be a little bit quicker when they're spaced, or PJ Washington in particular. Like, oh no, I might actually get this and I can go. And quickly to the PJ thing, something that stood out to me was how decisive he was. Like, you mentioned the drives and how important those are going to be. When PJ has it going, a guy that can knock down shots, a guy that can pump and go, and a guy that can even isolate against mismatches. The fact that there wasn't much hesitation for him in this game on Saturday is encouraging to me. He's going to have to keep that up. And to the shot-making portion, like, he wasn't the most efficient from three. That's going to have to perk up. Actually, he was spaced in the corner quite a bit in this game. So it's like, hey, wait, what is PJ shooting from the corners this year? Because, like, in my mind, I know he's generally been a solid one. About 37% on corner threes for his career. Career low on corner threes so far this year. So, like, obviously, that's going to have to perk up. But those opportunities are going to be there. Again, he was spaced quite a bit. I had a lot of fun watching Dallas just going with their double drag slash double pick and roll concepts. Tim Hardaway Jr. is your first screener. Gafford rolling. Josh Green as your first screener. Daniel Gafford rolling. PJ Washington should just be able to eat off of that. Everyone involved should be able to eat off of that. The lobs to Gafford are going to be there. The skips to PJ are going to be there. It's just fun watching them slide in. And again, not super fancy. The first time we've ever seen this ran or anything like that, but it popped. OKC did not have a lot of fun dealing with that. What you got?
This is a quick turnaround from your immediate questions after the Dallas trade.
No, because, like, they're good. Like, most of my questions boil down to, like, with PJ offensively, he's like, okay, how quickly will he make decisions? If he does so, if he's able to maintain that level of decisiveness that we saw Saturday, I don't have problems about the offensive fit. And I didn't really have questions, major questions about the offensive fit with either of those guys anyway. Most of my questions for them came defensively. How will PJ hold up against switches, which him immediately getting the Shea assignment, I was like, wait a minute, what is happening here? We'll see. You mentioned Daniel Gafford in the drop calling out late switches. Dallas also sprinkled in some zone when those guys ran. I was like, okay, they're trying stuff already. This feels like a very early, how much scheme versatility do we have with these guys in? So I'm going to continue to monitor that portion of it. But overall, the offensive fit really popped on Saturday. It even, too, like, talked about the lobs and some of the hit-aheads, because there were a lot of, like, 60-yard bombs thrown in this game. Dallas very quiet, like a 15% transition frequency in that game on Saturday, which would be league average. But for a team that's in the bottom 10 in transition frequency, and as a Dallas team that generally plays slower than most, the fact that those guys run the floor hard, PJ can fill a wing, catch the ball and shoot, catch the ball and drive. Daniel Gafford, you could toss it to him from half court. Just because of how the catch radius is wild there. Like, even that should help jumpstart some stuff for Dallas. And as we get into some of their second units, they generally play faster with Kyrie, no Luka, stuff like that. Dallas can have a lot of fun with lineups, and maybe they can get some easier baskets that way. Again, I'm going to continue to monitor where the defense lands, but positive debuts for both for me.
As a word you mentioned, versatility. And once PJ Washington was able to drive and knock down some shots, his versatility started to intrigue me. The ways they tried to use him as a screener intrigued me. In that second quarter, he's out there with Maxi Kleber. It gave Dallas two screeners there for a little bit. I think be able to play him with the second unit is where you can tap into a little bit more of the self-creation, the scoring flashes that we saw in Charlotte. So how does that open things up? Are they going to post him if teams switch? Does he slip and finish? Can he impact it that way? So can he now add on to what, you know, Dallas would need him to do? I think defensively, it's interesting. You mentioned, hey, I wasn't expecting to see him on Shea. Dallas needs that. Hey, we need you to guard. We need you to be able to guard multiple positions. So how much can he switch? I thought he was active off ball. I thought he worked hard. I mean, Shea got his points, but that's something you want to have in the back pocket. Now, a couple things I'm keeping an eye on. Daniel Gafford on the short roll is going to be a little bit new for him to a degree. If teams are going to put two on the ball against Luka or against Kyrie, how does he balance finishing against making those early catches in the pocket and making the reads and skipping the ball back out? Obviously, having the lob threat is not bad, but it's just something in the back of my mind. And then with Gafford, it's mainly just consistent, consistency with his activity in his drop. I thought he had a lot of really solid possessions as far as being in the right position, keeping the ball in front, communicating. He was talking, it felt like, the whole game. But there are those moments where you kind of saw the deep drop and he got beat. And so the wiggle room isn't as heavy. I think it helps considering Lively will come back. So now, hey, he can just have energetic, impactful minutes. But if he can clean that up with his ability on the weak side to show help, to rotate, to block shots, to protect the rim, I think that's big. Again, Daniel Gafford, one of three players averaging 2 blocks and 1 steal.
Seems pretty good.
Him, Victor, and Anthony Davis.
That is quite the group of people to be around. A quick question for you. Again, this is just game one, so rotation stuff is not settled. Derek Lively will be coming back. Do you foresee a path for either of them entering the starting lineup if we zoom out like a month from now? Or do you think they're both going to be really impactful bench players that could close if they're playing well?
I would probably lean towards closing more than starting. Because I don't know. My thing is, I don't know if you want to lessen their impact by putting them with the starting unit, because you know what the starting unit is. It's we're establishing Luka or Kyrie is also going to cook. So do we need that with them right away? Can we more so just build a unit that works with that and just break it up as we go? And now they can close if need be. So I think Washington would probably be more of a closer. Gafford, Lively is just so important. So that part's going to be a little bit tougher outside of foul trouble. But I'd probably say there's a pathway for Washington, but midseason, if you don't have to, you don't have to. Now, if he cooks to a certain level, I would understand. But I think being able to have the strength in those lineups is more important for Dallas.
Yeah, that makes sense. Like, I was more so asking through the lens of PJ anyway, because to your point, once Lively's back, and even with Maxi Kleber playing the way that he is, looking healthier, looks to be past the toe issue that was bothering him earlier in the year. Like, I think those 5 minutes are going to get pretty interesting. Like, even if Dallas wants the size of, say, Maxi at the 4-plus big, that probably trends towards Lively versus Gafford, sans injury or foul trouble, like you stated. With PJ, it's interesting just because, in theory, he can oscillate between the 3 and the 4. And I guess that's where I kind of look at what exactly are you getting offensively from Derrick Jones Jr. or Josh Green? Like, as we zoom out, if it gets to a point where, like, Derrick isn't back to knocking down shots at a high clip, or if some of the passivity comes back for Josh Green, does Jason Kidd get to a point where it's like, hey, how about we start one of these two then? Let's start Josh or Derrick. Let's get PJ in for more offense. And maybe you can find some balance there. Again, it's day one. I don't think they made the move now. But that's just trying to think through what it might look like in terms of lineups moving forward. So just wanted to get your thoughts there. Any closing thoughts before we move to the next game?
No.
All right. Fair enough. Let's go to New York. Bojan Bogdanović and Alec Burks both making their Knick debuts in a 125-111 loss to the Indiana Pacers. 11 points, 3 boards, and an assist off the bench for Bojan. Didn't shoot particularly well. Alec Burks with 22 points off the bench. Any early thoughts on how that went for them and what their usage looked like in that game?
No.
Ah,
of course I have thoughts. It felt very skeleton crew for the Knicks for me, obviously, because they made that trade. The one that had me in the headlock was Alec Burks was doing Alec Burks things, and it felt like that had more of a pop for the Knicks because they needed it to a degree. I think the fact that he subbed in for Jalen Brunson stood out for me as far as, okay, I think I see the vision as far as what Tibbs wants or needs from Alec Burks with this team right now. I think being able to have Burks and Bogdanović with that second unit start the second quarter stood out to me as well. It's a way to balance out your lineups. Again, when we talked about the trade when it happened, it's a plus for the Knicks, no doubt. How they balance the short term of no Julius Randle, no OG Anunoby, teams locking in on Jalen Brunson is going to be key. I think it's going to take some time to truly see how Bojan's going to be used, but I think he has the type of versatility that will fit for Tibbs. I think both of them do, as far as being able to create on-ball, off-ball. I think there's a lot more usage for Bogdanović in particular than we saw in that game. Against the Pacers, it felt like Bogey was just being used to space a lot in the corner. And the idea was just to try and punish or put pressure on defenses for how they were helping on Jalen Brunson. And so it was a lot of matchup hunting for the Knicks, it felt like, to try and get Jalen Brunson a matchup and not purely go with a big in pick and roll. And so you could see the moments where Bogey was stashed in the corner. And now once the help came against Brunson, the Knicks had them scrambling. We can move the ball. We can get an extra pass. You know, now we have Dante and Bogey on the same side. So that's two guys you're going to want to close out to. And I think Bogey's ability to drive closeout shouldn't be lost in that. But I thought that was the concept. Like, okay, we have a counter for some of this help you want to throw at us. Had a nice set for Bogey to start the second quarter, if I remember. I think it was Precious rolling. Bogey rises from the corner to the wing, hits a three. So I'd expect some more of that because more shooting is not a bad thing for the Knicks. But yeah, that's a to-be-determined type deal as the Knicks try and A, get healthy, B, figure out their rotations.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Like, I was chuckling thinking about it earlier. If you remember the OG debut and OG made comments, something to the effect of, I don't know what I'm doing yet, so I'm just going to cut. And just trying to find his way there. And I feel like with Boyan, it's like, well, I don't really know what I'm doing yet, so let me space and also screen. And then Alec Burks is just like, well, you know, I'm here. I will just take all the, I will attack in transition. I will boogie off pick and roll. Indy switched a bunch against him. Well, fine. I know what my role is here. I need to compete defensively and I will provide the buckets. But to your point, seeing how the Boyan usage expands as he, you know, in theory gets practices in and stuff, once his All-Star break gets in, like what that's going to look like, it's going to be fun. Didn't shoot particularly well, but to your point, the usage of the spacing was a sound one. Had him in the weak side corner to force rotations for Indiana if they did try to double Jalen Brunson. Had him in the strong side corner sometimes too to clear space for drives for Alec Burks, for Jalen Brunson. Boyan as a screener was interesting to me because this is something that you mentioned as being a part of the package for him once he joined New York. 13 on-ball picks set for Boyan in this game. That is a season high for him. Very heavy on the less mismatch hunt, but against non-indie teams. Like, I'm excited to see what that's going to look like when he can just punish smaller dudes. Or he can just pop out, set some of those ghost screens, see what kind of havoc that can create. And depending on how New York spaces beyond that, what kind of advantages can be created there. And in general, Jalen Brunson, this is a point that you've made earlier in the year as well. He seems very comfortable attacking length now, one-on-one at the very least. So if Boyan does screen for him and just gets a switch, okay, I have a bigger slash slower wing on me now. I can just boogie an ISO. You're not sending help from Boyan. And if Alec Burks is also a pass away, like, you don't really want to send help either. So, like, I'm going to be keeping an eye on exactly how they space overall with those two on the floor together. With Boyan and Alec Burks on the floor together with minus 4 in 22 minutes, and with those two on the floor without Jalen Brunson, it was a minus 7 in 11 minutes. But, like, it felt a lot better than those numbers indicate. Like, I do think they were able to generate some solid looks. The team as a whole went 2 of 9 from three while those two were on the floor without Brunson. And I would imagine with just better shooting, again, Boyan, I think, went, 2 of 6 from three. You get more efficiency there. Like, that's obviously going to balance out. But I was more impressed with just the way they were generating space, what kind of space they were opening up with someone like the Burks, Precious Achiuwa pick and rolls, being able to get the ball in Josh Hart's hands a little bit more. And now you got more space for him to operate with. Like, what is that going to do for his drives? And just the presence of having Boyan and Alec Burks there, how much pressure is that going to take off of Deuce McBride? And what can you unlock with him? Are you running more things with him used as a screener now? Like, I think there's going to be a world of possibilities there with those second units. And if you can figure that stuff out, the minutes without Jalen Brunson on the floor, even when Randle and OG come back, that should all feel better.
Well, I mean, you don't want to call injuries a positive, but that's the flip side for the Knicks. You do have some more of that wiggle room to figure out how can we use these guys, what lineups work. So now you can kind of build a base on top of what you already have with Brunson, with Randle, with OG. So how they kind of navigate it will be fun going forward.
Got you. And a quick question for you before we move to the next one. Again, it's day one, no red button to be pressed. How did you feel about Burks and Boyan defensively in that one?
I felt fine. You?
Mostly okay. Like, I think once they were in rotation, some of those closeouts got a little wonky, but, like, neither one of them were brought in to be defensive stoppers, so not necessarily a surprise there. But I guess I just want I guess in the back of my mind, it's just like, okay, this doesn't look great. What is the appetite for Tibbs going to be for like some of the Boyan at the four lineups? And seeing like what, how much comfort he has defensively there. But again, it's day one, so like we'll just see what that looks like moving forward. But nothing surprising, but could have been better. It's kind of where I land there. Let's go to Philly very quickly. Two games over the weekend for the Sixers, or two games post-trade, rather. Buddy Hield with 20 points, 4 rebounds, and 6 assists. Campaign with 20 points and 6 assists, and a 127-121 loss to Atlanta. And then against Washington, 23-5-6-4 for Buddy Hield, 6 points and 6 assists off the bench for Campaign. What were some of your biggest takeaways from the early Buddy and Cam experience in Philly?
I think for me with Buddy Hield, it showed how he can help the Sixers both now and later. I think his ability to shoot in space and score is key. It jumps off the page. Everyone can see it. What Philadelphia converts that into is where my eyes go, and starting to see how they wanted to add things. And those first two games was key. A lot of things, obviously, we can point to once Joel Embiid does come back. I think the real value is just Buddy Hield being able to help the Sixers and open up the playbook offensively and add to what they can try and run as they try and find ways to generate offense without Joel Embiid. Using him on ball with dribble handoffs or in pick and roll or in pistol action, I thought that was a plus. I don't think Buddy Hield's going to get an automatic 2 on the ball or at the level or a trap. But those moments where he can engage the defense, can that open up a role for someone? Can that open up a kick? How much can they tap into that? The off-ball movement, I think, is going to be huge for Philadelphia, especially so they can mix and match things, especially with teams locking in on Tyrese Maxey. I mean, even if you're just running floppy with Buddy and Maxey both flying off screens, basic set, but you have to worry about Buddy Hield flying off one side. You're going to engage. Someone's going to chase. The big's going to make sure I'm ready. That's going to allow Maxey to fly off the other side. And even just in the little things, but him having that room to operate without a defense fully engaged on him is so important. Anytime you can get Tyrese Maxey going downhill just feels like a plus for Philly right now as they're trying to navigate. Now, the one thing that intrigued me, especially against the Wizards with Buddy Hield, using Buddy Hield as an on-ball screener for Tyrese Maxey. And I think that's something we've seen from Buddy Hield a lot in the past, had a lot of success with it in Indiana. I do think those two have value together. So being able to clear both wings, being able to let Buddy Hield come up with some pace and slip. Now you combine that with the speed of a Tyrese Maxey and his ability to turn the corner. Obviously, teams can probably get a beat on it, can work the switch. But when you're able to work and get just that hint of indecision as far as, do I need to stay with Buddy? Oh, Tyrese Maxey's coming a million miles an hour. That helps. I think especially to have Tyrese Maxey not have to use a big all the time is a plus right now, especially with the way that teams are looking to defend him right now. Anything you do to free him up and get him downhill should be a plus for Philadelphia. So I think that's where I think Buddy Hield can really add a lot of value to their team, and you're seeing it right from the start.
Like, you see the Sixers acquire Buddy Hield, and the first thing you go to is the shooting and the spacing that he provides. You kind of bank that in, and then you watch the Hawks game and you watch the Wizards game, it's just like, oh, this is going to be entirely different for Tyrese Maxey and even Tobias Harris. Like, you mentioned them running floppy. I think to their very basic, like, Tyrese Maxey brings up the floor, pitch to Tobias Harris, pitch back, I can go. Doing that with Buddy Hield is an entirely different thing, just because Buddy Hield can ghost all over the place. And if you aren't tight there, like, that's a catch and shoot opportunity for Buddy Hield. If you rotate too hard to that, that's an extra swing, or he can attack, get downhill a little bit. Not an elite finisher, but someone that can puncture your defense and get you in scramble mode. And I think the broader context of Philly right now with no Joel Embiid is, how exactly can we get defenses moving aside from defenses dictating turns? We're putting 2 on Tyrese Maxey, and we dare you to do stuff. How much can we bring to them with some of the stuff that we run? And I think Buddy Hield popped in a major way there. Like, I personally enjoyed the Hawks game. Yes, you talked about him as a screener. They're just spamming Spain pick and roll to see what they can get against Atlanta. It's like, huh, that looks familiar. This is cool. And then even with the Wizards game, again, just simple high pick and roll, Buddy go screen. Double drag, Buddy Hill's your first screener. You mentioned floppy, him coming off the ball. And it's just like, teams are not going to have fun dealing with not only Buddy's shooting ability and the gravity he has there, the off-ball movement as well. And like that was something that really popped early in the Hawks game and somewhat in the Wizards game, where I think there's going to be a real learning period for both Buddy and the Sixers for like what he likes to do off the ball. Because there is a randomness to the way that he moves off the ball. Very unconventional. I'm in the right corner. Now I'm going to go up, zig back down to the free throw line, and then jet up to the left wing. Not even like a ghost screen, but like I would just move while the action's going on. And as they get used to those paths from Buddy, defenses aren't going to have fun. I think you'll see more fluidity there from Philadelphia offensively, so that if things break down, it doesn't have to be Kelly Oubre save us, Tyrese Maxey save us. We now get moving from Buddy. If you make a mistake, oh, we can play out of that. We can open up, drive, and kick once again and have some fun flowing out of that. And to your Buddy Hield on ball point, 20 on ball screens set against Washington, season high for him, almost a career high. Second time in his NBA career that he set at least 20 on ball screens in a game. He had a 24 game last year. So atypical usage for Buddy in terms of the volume, but certainly not new in what he brings to the offensive package. And then again, outside of his actual movement, him being on the floor makes defenses account for him in a way that I don't think Philly is used to and will get used to and will have fun exploiting. As I was watching some of the Tyrese Maxey drives against Washington in particular, it sprung a thought like, okay, let's be nerdy. Let's look up some drive stuff. Let's look up some drive stats. 85 drives for the Philadelphia 76ers through two games with Buddy Hield on the floor. Over 1.1 points per possession on those trips, which would be one of the best marks in the NBA. In terms of help defenders being present, that's something else that Second Spectrum tracks. On the year, help defenders are present around 75% of Philadelphia drives. That's a middle of the pack number. With Buddy Hield on the floor, that drops down to 62.4%, which would easily be the lowest mark in the NBA. With Boston and OKC, your top two, that's around 69%. So it's a two-game sample. That's 85 total team drives with Buddy on the floor. So, like, obvious caveats there. But, like, that's a very quick reference point to, oh, Buddy being on the floor really changes some stuff for Philadelphia. And as they get more comfortable, as they be able to blend in those actions more, and, again, hopefully moving forward, you get Embiid back, that's going to be another layer. That's going to be another wave that they can throw into the half court. And I really enjoyed it. Also, multiple multi-assist games for Buddy Hield so far. And then very quickly, before we move on to the next couple of players, since they were more of the lower minute variety, how have you felt about the Buddy defense so far? Because that was one of the question marks that I had about the move.
I think it's a fair question mark to have. I do wonder what it's going to look like in a playoff context when teams are going to look to attack him. Won't be anything new for him. So far in Philly, I've really liked, you know, he's competing on defense. The weak side and off-ball defense has felt stronger than anticipated. I think he's shown good early help, shown an ability to stunt and recover back to his. I think that's a big plus. So it ties into the foundation that Philly's had defensively so far this year, where, hey, we're going to compete, we're going to get after it, team defense, help, rotate. So thumbs up for me so far. Now, we're going to see a game where someone looks to attack him at some point, but it doesn't feel like a liability zone type scenario.
Got you. Like, that's one of those things where I won't say that I was like super enthused watching the Hawks and the Wizards game, but that's something that I want to see if they are able to get Embiid back, because in theory, he should be better insulated versus those let's just clear out and attack Buddy type situations. When you have Embiid on the back line and just some collective length between Tobias Harris, Kelly Oubre, if he's on the floor. So, like, they should be better equipped to kind of hide him in that matter. If they aren't able to nail that, just Tyrese Maxey because of the size and Buddy Hield together, like, I don't think that's going to be super dissimilar to what Tyrese and Buddy had to deal with in Indiana. Just in terms of, we will just put y'all two in action. We'll go guard. Let's just have some fun. We're going to force y'all to send help from somewhere. Again, Philly should be better equipped to deal with that, but the problem itself may not be completely eliminated. So, again, we'll see when it beats back what that's going to look like, but something worth keeping eyes on moving forward. Oh, quickly, while we're on Philly, I mentioned campaign and just didn't say anything else outside of his box score. Some fun pick and rolls for him. Like, I think he provides a little bit more off the dribble juice than Pat Bev did, though I do still feel like some of the drives and just the connective ability that Pat Bev has in the half court goes a little under the radar because you think about the defense and some of the antics that come along with that. And we'll talk about Pat Bev shortly. But I do think Campaign can puncture defenses in a way that like Pat Bev couldn't consistently anyway. And that popped off in particular in the Atlanta game. So I think that's going to be fun. And then him shifting to the bench role in the second game. Again, it's also a little bit hard to judge some of the openings that he saw because Washington doesn't have the best defense. So like there's at least a speck of salt to throw in with some of the looks and some of the openings he was able to create, all due respect. But that should be some much needed bench juice. And as the team gets healthier, like he should be able to pack a powerful punch coming off the bench for Philly.
Well, I know we're going to talk about Pat Bev later, but it feels like I understand why they made the swap because some of what Campaign does offensively, Philly may need more right now. Now, obviously, they've also made another move, so we'll see how that truly lines up. But you could just feel, okay, they might need some more of his pick and roll pop, some more of his driving. I think that stands out to me. And I just wonder how much usage does he get? How much pop does he get? Because I got Kyle Lowry in the back of my brain now. Mm-hmm. So now I'm trying to figure out, okay, what does this mean, so to speak?
Let's move to Phoenix very quickly. With Royce O'Neal making his debut off the bench, modest box score, 3 points, 4 boards, an assist, a steal, and a block. In a 113-112 loss to Golden State. Steve, what popped for you in the Royce debut?
A lot. Honestly, at first when he came in, obviously limited minutes, but it felt very much like let me get in where I fit in type of vibe, type of beat, spaced, trying to set a screen for somebody, crashing the offensive glass, Bradley Beal's pushing it. Hey, let me screen you. Oh, wait, let me get out the way. Connector type activity. But I think that's going to be valuable for Phoenix, and it will be fun to see how they use him and how that develops. The one thing that caught my eye offensively, and it goes back to his time in Brooklyn this year, where it was like, hey, Royce O'Neal's kind of doing a lot of stuff with the ball right now. Mm-hmm. It feels like a little bit more on-ball usage for Royce O'Neal. And it won't be the same in Phoenix just because of their personnel, but it was interesting to see, okay, if you want to try and stash someone on Royce O'Neal, we can use that against you. Have a Kevin Durant screen, have a Devin Booker screen, and see if we can get a switch, trust you can get the ball in the right place. Or if you mess it up, we'll turn the corner, try and get a driving kick, try and start things that way. I don't expect much there, but it's just something to keep an eye on going forward. The big value for me was just the weak side defense. And I know your big question mark with Royce O'Neal is what would it look like if he's overtasked? I think his I think his defensive versatility really fits in with what Phoenix wants to do. It's going to help them overall. Because if you think about it, it was interesting at the start in that Warriors game, he's guarding GP2. He's able to show help on the weak side, showing early nail help. That's a plus. That helps the Suns defense, which they need some of that base type beat. Let me show help. Let me recover. I got your back. That's going to be big for them. Then he ends up guarding Klay Thompson. Now he's navigating off ball screens. Then he ends up guarding Jonathan Kuminga. And they had some fun battles in the post, but working to contain penetration, looking to navigate screens on ball, throw some switching in. The fact that he can defend multiple positions, he can do it on and off ball, has the size and length to be switchable. I just think that's good value for Phoenix to have someone who can do a little bit of everything defensively. And the biggest thing is it just popped off. Okay, I think he can help their lineup versatility, especially as he plays more minutes, as Phoenix gets more comfortable, he gets more ingrained with the system. I just look at some of the lineups he was out there with. Eric Gordon, Devin Booker, Grayson Allen, Royce O'Neal, Eubanks. Then it was Beal, Gordon, Booker, O'Neal, Eubanks. Then it was Beal, Gordon, O'Neal, Bull, Eubanks. You know what I mean?
Shout out to Bull real quick.
Get your iPads out, folks. But that kind of helps in the playoff context to where, okay, we have at least a couple of these that we feel comfortable with. And that's where I want to see how it grows and what kind of minutes he gets. But I think that's a plus. They're going to be able to trust him. Like, I know we've all said, hey, can Phoenix find the fifth? If one option is Grayson Allen, if one option is Eric Gordon, and one option is Royce O'Neal, you can probably navigate the playoff series if you're healthy, right?
Yeah, like in theory, that it's nice to have those options. And as you were going through the lineups there, something else that that's something that I had in my notes as well. One thing we didn't see with Royce yet is big three out there, Royce out there, another spacer, KD at the five. I do wonder when they press that particular button with him, if that's just going to be a matchup deal or a let's get a practice in type beat, because to your point, he did a lot in that Golden State games, just in terms of who he was defending and the play types he was defending. The post-ups and the drives versus Jonathan Kuminga. You mentioned the Klay Thompson off-ball stuff. And so, like, it's valuable that he can be trusted to do all of those things. Again, I will continue to monitor the volume. And if we do get the KD at five with Bill, with Booker, with Royce, and let's say it's Grayson Allen, if you really want to just maximize the spacing, Royce will have to take on some pretty tough assignments there. And if his assignment is dealing with off-ball stuff and now you got him switching and teams are able to play with the matchups there, like, Phoenix still has some things to figure out on that front, but we won't see that until we get the minutes. But to your point, like, very encouraging that as he was actively trying to find his way with Phoenix offensively, it never really felt like he was stepping on toes. It was a very quick realization, okay, you don't need me here. Let me just space over here then. That's cool. Let me try to time this cut right here. Let me see if I can crash the offensive glass, see if I can generate something extra. And now I'll just defend my tail off. Plus four in 11 minutes, which plus minus isn't everything, but just him walking in with maybe not the most optimized lineup there. We haven't seen the KD at the five with him yet. 1 to minutes already. And this is without him having like the 12.6 assist game that we might see in Brooklyn. I'm excited to see what the drive is going to look like. I'm excited to see what the screening usage will look like for Bill, for Booker, even for KD. And just him being able to be stashed on the weak side, both as a shooter, but as someone that can puncture a gap as a driver, I think is going to be very important, especially once you consider the volume of double teams that Phoenix normally faces with KD or Devin Booker on the block in particular. If he's now the second or even third pass off of that double team, he's going to see more room than he's seen in, what, a year and a half, 2 years? If that. So I'm excited to see what the fit's going to look like. But just a small sample so far in game one. We will be keeping tabs on it moving forward. And then Milwaukee. Talked a little bit about Patrick Beverley. 6 points, 4 assists, plus 8 off the bench in a 120-84 win over the Charlotte Hornets, who, you know, continue not to have the best season. But did anything in particular pop with Patrick Beverley in his debut?
A lot popped, including the crowd. I mean, is there anything more Pat Bev than just getting there and grabbing the clipboard and talking to Brooke Lopez, who was a top defender last year? I know Brooke hit him with the, all right, I got you. And literally, as I typed my notes, I wrote, at some point, Patrick Beverley and Bobby Portis are going to have the Pfizer forum going crazy, right? And then literally, I clicked play. Here comes a stop. Pat Bev hits a three, almost knocks Steve Clifford over. They get another stop. Pat Bev knows the assignment, gets it right to Giannis. It goes to a Bobby Portis three. Crowd goes crazy. I'm like, ah, there it is. I think for me, this is one of those things where you have to understand that what you may think of a player may not be the whole story, and what they do may have value somewhere else. And so, yes, you want to point to the Patrick Beverley antics. I fully understand. But if you're looking at a Milwaukee team, defense probably isn't their strength. You've been talking about point of attack defense. Let's widen that out, though. Little things defensively. I've been firmly on the little things defensively for Milwaukee train for a long time now. And what Patrick Beverley is going to bring is defense, energy, experience. He comes in late in that first quarter for Dame. You look out there, it's Pat Bev, Pat Connaughton, Jay Crowder, Giannis, Bobby Portis. Some dogs out there, right? Mm-hmm. So his ball pressure, you know, it's not just quote-unquote point of attack. He can help the switchability of that unit. That screen navigation can help Bobby Portis be active. But more importantly, that lineup or his defense, it's going to allow Giannis to roam and help on the weak side. And that's where Giannis is the most effective as a defender. Little things, being able to switch in front in the post, knowing when to show help, knowing when to get back out, knowing when to stunt and recover, which is a lost art. Those are things that Milwaukee hasn't had. We can talk about the scheme all we want. Every scheme is going to have a weakness. Your personnel is your personnel. Can you clean those things up? Can you give yourself a better chance? Offensively, we saw this last year in Chicago. Say what you want about Pat Bev. He knows the assignment. I think there's value there. for Milwaukee, which seems odd because in theory you would say Campaign's a better offensive player, right? Mm-hmm. Better offensive player is going to do what?
Yes, a little bit of everything.
Okay. So with Pat Bev, I know when to take three. He has some bad misses in that one. Know when to look to drive. Know when to swing it real quick. End of the first half, Damian Lillard splits, driving kick to Patrick Beverley. Yes, I said that. He goes right to a pass to Malik Beasley. Like, not even, I think he did it midair, like a double pump. And they hit a three. They get a three out of it. There's value in being able to stop Andre Jackson Jr. during a dead ball and show him the defensive rotation he may have had to make. That's the kind of stuff you get. That's where it's like, okay, I understand. We've got the buzzwords. We've got the reputation. We've got the thoughts and the feelings. This is beyond just Pat Bev. It goes, we could point to it with every trade. Context matters, folks. And that's where I think his boost is going to come. And you don't have to play him heavy minutes. We might not see his true impact.
If you get the Pat Bev package in 14, 15 minutes a game, you get the defense, you get the off-ball communication, you get the rotations, you get the timely drives, you get the timely shot making. And if you can annoy a person or two without flipping the game, I think you take that if you are Milwaukee. It's very quickly to the defense portion, as you nailed all the off-ball stuff. Just very early on, checks in. Hey, Nick Smith Jr., nice seeing you dribble. Be a shame if I just pressure you full court. Oh, you're going screening action now. Oh, bet. You're trying to do this flare from Miles Bridges like you always do. Let me pressure you, navigate this screen from Nathan Bensa, duck under, get attached to Miles Bridges, and now we're funneling. Like, it's just like, that's not going to be a steal for Patrick Beverley on the box score. It's not going to be a stop for him directly. But it's like, oh, you can just put out a lot of fires that Milwaukee hasn't done a good job of putting out this year just by doing your job, navigating, playing with energy. Like, that little stuff's going to pop. And as you were talking about his drives and knowing when to puncture defense there, like, one of my favorite drives from him in that game was a missed layup that ended with Giannis' offensive rebound, I believe, and he ends up getting fouled. But it's all right, cool. Bobby and Giannis at the elbow. Pick from Bobby, flares off of Giannis. We got Giannis a touch against Miles Bridges. Funny thing, because literally all five Hornet defenders converge in the paint, like, not you, bud. Kick out to Pat Bev, good rotation in the corner beside him. All right, bet. I'm catching, I'm going. I got a layup. Missed the shot, but it's like, okay, he seized the opportunity there. Like, okay, this is my one. If I'm going to take a shot at the rim, where I'm not looking off Giannis or looking off Dame from the floor together, whatever the case may be. That situational awareness, and again, his ability to make quick decisions as a driver, I think it should pop as the minutes expand, if they expand, or just as he gets more comfortable in Milwaukee. And so, like, this should be a pretty positive one. Like, I enjoyed the Pat Bev antics, the crowd pop, but ultimately, I feel like he gave Milwaukee good stuff on both ends of the floor. Any closing Pat Bev thoughts before we get into some of these other ones? We'll go more rapid fire with these. But
no.
All right, fair enough. Well, let's go to Brooklyn while we're talking about point guards. Dennis Schroeder with 15 points and 12 assists and also was a plus 10 off the bench in a 123-103 win over the San Antonio Spurs. I'll go quickly. We talked about the drives on Thursday, or I guess technically the Friday drop. We talked about how important drives would be, how important the paint pressure would be. It's not like his speed is underrated, because if you've watched Dennis Schroeder for literally 5 seconds, you know how fast he is. But like, watching how impactful his speed was as a driver with these Brooklyn bigs in particular was something that stood out to me as I was watching. And I was like, you know, there's the general switch question against Brooklyn and what they can create against that. But even when they see drop, like, can their guards engage the big in a way that makes them a threat and also open things up for their rollers? I would say that's been pretty inconsistent for them this year. Dennis Schroeder just being able to put his foot on the gas and frankly outrun his defender and just force the big man to to step up to him. Like, oh, well, my guy's beat. I kind of have to at least shift my body, open up this way. It's opening up pocket passes for Nick Claxton. It's opening up these dump offs for Dayron Sharp, who, again, not the most explosive athlete. If you can create an extra 6 or 7 inches of space for him to catch cleanly, gather without the ball bobbling or someone swiping down, he has a better chance at finishing some of these shots. Like, it's a very small thing, but it's just like he's creating an extra pocket that wasn't there, even in drop. It's not Dennis Schroeder speed demon, three defenders converge and has an open three for someone like a star creator would. But even just that little bit of help within drop should make life easier for the bigs. And so, like, I really enjoyed that portion. the freaking, I thought he went between the legs with the pass, but zooming in, he didn't. But like that feed to Nick Claxton on the pick and roll that got him a dunk there, got fancy with it. I was like, oh, Dennis is very happy to be here and or excited to just not be in Toronto coming off the bench. And so we'll keep tabs on if he will continue to come off the bench in Brooklyn. But very fun stuff from Dennis Schroeder in his debut. What popped for you in that one?
Well, I mean, just to bounce off your offense point, when you talk about Brooklyn, I thought Dennis Schroeder's drives and his paint touches would be important. I think the Nets have talent. I think the issue has been how do they get a team in rotation for the majority of the time. I think him being able to come off the bench opens some things up. Those being able to use Cam Thomas off ball and off screens, Mikal Bridges off ball and off screens has a little bit more juice and impact. I think Dennis Schroeder's ability to both start a play and finish a play is key. I think sometimes if Brooklyn runs a set, okay, how do we end it? Or, hey, we're starting here. We might just get a shot out of it. A little bit more organization that way, which I think falls under the radar. I think his ability to attack against drop was huge, engaging the defense. And I just like the fact that, hey, we have someone who's going to get in the paint. We have someone who's going to force help, and we can play out of that. That's something Brooklyn's needed. Hence, every time we see Ben Simmons, his play pops. Dennis Schroeder's play popped. When Brooklyn can kind of get downhill like that offensively, that helps. And now you see Nick Claxton rolling. You see Dorian Finney-Smith rolling. You just see more of, okay, we're running offense with a purpose as opposed to let's hope this works. I thought it was interesting that they went with Dennis Schroeder and Dennis Smith Jr. and Cam Thomas, little three-guard lineup. That was fun. I think the defense of Schroeder and Smith Jr. kind of insulates. I think the defense of Schroeder intrigued me probably more than I thought. I wasn't anticipating it, but he comes out full court pressure. I'm like, oh, this is fun. And now he's pressuring the ball. You got Dennis Smith Jr. denying. You got Nick Claxton denying. Oh, this is fun. You got your activity up. And now Cam Thomas is over there on the weak side. That's a plus for Brooklyn. So it's more just like, I understand why they made that move. And sometimes you just need an injection of energy and something different to kind of pop.
I got you. That should be with Dennis, with the other Dennis, and also Nick. Like, that is a fun defensive foundation. Like, I think just general spacing concerns, I think it's going to limit some of the fun combination they can go with defensively. I am kind of here for, like, 16 seconds left, Brooklyn up two, or Brooklyn up three, we got to protect the lead. Can you get to both Dennis's, Nick Claxton and Ben Simmons on the floor together to get a stop? Be something that you could at least think about playing with. Not free throw shooting with Nick Claxton and Ben probably – we'll probably lead the job on and be like, okay, maybe not. But like for me, like that's fun for me to envision. And the fact that they have that option is something. I'm glad you mentioned the full court pressure from Dennis. Just being able to bleed some of the time off the clock and limit some of the off-ball decisions that some of the younger guys have to make, I think could be valuable for them, even if that doesn't show up in a traditional stat sheet. That should be fun. But fruitful stuff for Dennis. On the other end of that trade, again, Spencer Dinwiddie was waived as part of this deal. And we will talk about his landing spot shortly. But Kelly Olynyk with 11 points, 6 boards, 3 assists, 3 steals, and a block. Off the bench, Oshai Agbaji with 8 points and 2 boards. Off the bench in a 119-95 loss in their debut. I think for me, like you saw some of the early usage for Kelly. Steve is laughing because I typed the team down wrong in the doc. So it's like, oh no, not like this. But I think some of the early usage for Kelly, not necessarily surprising, but it's like, okay, I see what this may look like. Just getting into some of the handoff stuff, some of the split stuff. I keep an eye on some of the lineups that we saw with both Kelly and Oshai out there. We also have Bruce Brown. You also have Scotty Barnes. You also have Grady in there. That feels like a lot of, in theory, a lot of spacing, a lot of utility to go side to side if necessary. In theory, you should be able to post Scotty. And if he draws any layer of attention, you have 3 or 4 guys that should be able to puncture that either as a shooter or as a driver. So like that portion should be fun. And to the driving portion, I want to keep an eye on Oshai and what he's able to do against tilted defenses. I think the shooting is the thing that probably pops the most with him. And he hasn't shot particularly well throughout his NBA career so far. But like, will he be able to leverage that into more fruitful drives? Will he be more aggressive as a driver? That's going to be something for me to track moving forward with Toronto. But it was fun to see some of the flashes of what that could look like, what that lineup in particular could look like. But obviously, you don't want that big of a loss. Things that kind of hazy. That was against Cleveland. But
how did you feel about the defense?
Well, mostly eh, to be completely honest with you. Like, it wasn't stopper stuff from Oshai, and Kelly's going to work, but that still very much feels like we need to insulate Kelly as much as we can. If he does switch, what kind of help are we going to be able to show behind that? If you play him higher, what's that going to look like against a drop? Can he contest without fouling? Because guards can generally chew up that space against him when he is in a drop. So it's mostly F. But again, it's, I guess it's similar to like the Buddy Hield thing where it's like, okay, I'm kind of coming into this with this might be an issue. So I'm not going to like hammer it home too much right now in Dame 1. But nothing super surprising on that front.
I'm going to give them a little grace and wiggle room as they face the Cavs. I was intrigued that the belief in Kelly Olynyk's versatility led to him and Jakob Poeltl being on the floor at the same time. And then I also looked at Agbaji and Grady playing at the same time. I was like, ah, I see what we're trying to do here. We're trying to build up our wings, trying to use the versatility. So I'm going to pause because you could see how Kelly Olynyk can help, but I'd like to see him more integrated as far as handoffs go, spacing goes. I just figured I'd pick your brain on that because maybe I could unlock another Raptors rant.
If there's one thing I could...
Oh, you took it. Never mind.
No, I was going to say just one thing I would say on Toronto as a whole. Can we not make literally every game like the defining game of Scottie Barnes' career? Can we just not do that? Like, I don't need a Scottie triple-double to mean he's like unironically the face of the league. Shout out Darko. And I also don't need like the 14-7-4 game from Scottie where he doesn't shoot well to be... His effort sucks. Why did we trade Pascal and OG? What are we doing? Not a number one. Like, can we not do that in a very obvious, like, during a very obvious organizational shift? Can we just relax? Let's take the good. Let's keep note of the bad versus it just being any game is confirmation of Scottie's going to be top five or Scottie can't do this. But can we just not do that? Like, that's just a general young player thing. But because I follow so many Raptor folks, I just see it on my timeline a bunch. So it's really just a me issue, to be clear. Like, this is my fault. But like, let's relax. He's young. It's literally year one of Scottie being this. And injury replacement. But like, he's an all-star this year. Like, let's take a deep breath with some of the Scottie conversations. That's all I got.
Ooh, unlocked. All right. And now, folks, we get to talk in Nekias. Give us some Charlotte Hornets thoughts.
Well, this is when I point out on a broader Charlotte note. 30 assists in the 115-106 win against Memphis. Five of their last six games with 30-plus assists. I feel like, Steve, you would enjoy that stat in particular. But 15-8 off the bench for Grant Williams. Micic with 18 points and 9 assists off the bench. Trey Mann started 9 points and 9 assists with a pair of steals. Seth Curry and Davis Bertan combining for 4 threes off the bench in that one. It was a very obvious, oh, we have room to do stuff type game. And with Micic in particular, and Steve made the point on the last pod, like solid in OKC, but maybe it wasn't the cleanest stylistic fit for what he wants to do. How about a season high of nearly 30 pick and rolls ran for Micic in the Charlotte debut? It's almost like, and this is what Charlotte, as Steve mentioned pre-show, this is what Charlotte being a high-volume pick-and-roll team to begin with, he should just have more room to do stuff. Especially when you zoom out and look at the rest of the guard room. With no LaMelo, it's like, okay, it's Micic, it's Nick Smith Jr. right now. Like, Ish Smith was waived. He's going to have all the room in the world to be able to create, and I'm excited to see, like, the passing pop in a bigger way in Charlotte. But the movement was a lot of fun. I also must say, as I watched this game earlier this morning, why did Memphis look like they had never seen an empty side pick and roll before in that game? I was very disappointed in Jaren in particular. I'm just like, brother, what's happening right now? Like, this is still very much just pro Charlotte because I like a lot of good stuff. Like, they mixed up the usage for Grant. We saw the shots go in, so that was a positive. I'm sure that might have annoyed Mavs fans. But beyond that, used as a screener, got to run a straight pick and roll. We saw some of the drives against closeouts. So Grant got to do a little bit of everything. Self-flying golf ball. Trey Mann getting to run empty side stuff. But I had to throw the Memphis Nugget in there. I'm just like, dog, all due respect to Nick Richards, he shouldn't be running as free as he was on some of these roles. But no, I enjoyed the ball movement there. Real emphasis to push pace. And they were able to blend in the pick and rolls and just the general off-ball movement to really put Memphis' defense in a bind. They created a lot of good looks. Again, 30 assists in that game, but it could have been a lot more if shots fell at a higher degree. So I enjoyed the Charlotte debut for a lot of those votes.
Can I ask you a quick follow-up question?
Sure.
Did Trey Mann just watch all the Terry Rozier film that he could?
I hope so. Which I think I made like the flare point during the pod. And like it wasn't a lot of that in game one. But him setting bat screens and then flying off and flowing into stuff from there, like that was a lot of fun. Like I think this is going to be a stretch where I look at, hey, Trey, how willing are you to do this? Like you're coming from OKC. Which they are not shy about using their guards as screeners on and off the ball. You're getting a whole bunch of playing time now. Are you able to do all that stuff plus showcase the on-ball usage? Get to the step back that we know that he can knock down whenever he wants to. Or at the very least, create a whole bunch of space when he goes to it. 9 assists, they weren't all of like the no-look, weak side, skip to the corner, stuff like that. There were a lot of like handoff stuff, just pass to a guy coming off the screen. So like not the purest of 9 assists, but him having his head up and looking to move the ball, I think is encouraging. And I hope that is a broader growth area for him versus I just got here, let's move it and make a good impression. So I'm going to continue to monitor that portion, just the scoring passing balance for Trey Mann. But this is a solid opportunity for him. Like he's going to get the minutes. If the 3-point shot bounces back and he's able to find that balance as a creator, no reason in the world he can't just be a solid rotation piece for Charlotte moving forward.
I think opportunity is a key word there. And like when I saw the amount of pick and roll ball handler possessions that Charlotte had compared to OKC, I was like, okay, Micić might fit a little bit better here.
Yeah.
It's less because of what a player can't do and more what a team is asking them to do, what a team needs for them to do. I think OKC had progressed in a way where they didn't need purely a big to screen and roll to unlock things. They got a lot of guard screens. They got a lot of cutting, a lot of driving. Charlotte needs more of that. And then when you talk about Grant Williams, it's interesting to kind of see what does Grant Williams do in this context? A lot of talks, understood. He got his shot to a certain level. The issue with the context he was in Boston, in Dallas, we're guarding you this way. You have to make X amount of shots to beat us. We may still guard you this way. And so with more wiggle room, what does he look like? Do we see more of the drives? Do we see more of the impact that way? So I think that's interesting there. So thumbs up for me. It's just nice to kind of see guys in different contexts have fun. Can I ask another question?
Sure.
Did the Pistons trade for Simone Fontecchio or did they trade to allow Jaden Ivey and Marcus Sasser to do more things?
The answer is yes. The answer is very firmly yes. What a stretch for we probably just need to dedicate like an actual segment to Jaden Ivey at some point. That man has been playing out of his mind as of late. So it's smart of them to clear that room and clear that opportunity for Jaden to cook. Marcus Sasser continues to be like under the radar because the Pistons overall have just been bad. Like Marcus Sasser has quietly been one of the better pick and roll players in the league this year. If you want to get into some numbers on that portion of it. But it's nice to clear that room. And then as for Simone, who had, I believe, 20 points, 9 boards off the bench for Detroit against the Clippers. One, that was just an incredibly funny basketball game. As we were hosting a watch party, we were bouncing back and forth between that one and the Dallas game. We turn into that game, and the Clippers are up 12-2. And by the time it goes to commercial break, it's like 14-all. It's like, oh, no. And the Pistons very well could have won that game if the Clippers didn't take that back over in the fourth quarter. But the usual stuff, if you've been watching Utah at all, or if you watched our video on Utah Jazz earlier in the year, all of that stuff popped. Well, he saw small defenders and shot right over the top. They ran him off of stuff off the ball to get three-point shots. When defense is tilted, you got to see some nice passing flashes. Nothing super advanced there, but kept things moving. And his ability to kind of fit in that off-ball role, playing off of the boogieing of Marcus Sasser, off of the pure speed drives from Jaden Ivey, playing off of Kay for that matter. Like, that's such a strong fit, which is why I was not super upset with Detroit trading for him. As he, again, as he hits restricted free agency, like, I don't think that's going to be, he's not getting 20 mil a year from someone. And 28 ain't 38. So, like, he should be able to age well alongside his core. Like, he's not 30 yet. And even if he gets a 3-4 year deal, like, going to be early 30s by the time it's over with. But, like, just his headiness off the ball, his shooting ability, his ability to read what he needs to do against a tilted defense, that should all fit alongside all those young ball handlers. It's not going to be 20-9 every night. The rebounding in particular surprised me a bit. But I think the scoring and just general off-ball value for him, I think, is really going to pop in Detroit. And they've needed it. It's not a coincidence, as we bemoan what Detroit's offense looks like for most of the year, they get Mike Muscala in the room. It's like, huh, this is more room. This looks a whole lot better. You get Simone in the room. Huh, there's more spacing and shooting. This looks better. They should be able to build off of that. And even if it doesn't end in a whole bunch of wins for Detroit post-All-Star break, the offense should look cleaner. It should feel better.
I'm with you. That's all I had.
Okay, fair enough.
Do you have any news?
Well, yeah, let's get into some news to close this thing out. As mentioned earlier, Spencer Dinwiddie was traded to Toronto, but then waived, so not going to play there. The Los Angeles Lakers signing Spencer Dinwiddie to a 1-year deal. I think it's 1.5 mil, so a little bit of the MLE, not just the minimum for him. But Dinwiddie on the year, averaging 12.6 points per game, 48% on twos, 32% from three, 78% from the line, but not getting to the line all that often this year. Six assists. Steve, what kind of impact do you foresee Dinwiddie having in Los Angeles?
I think for me, the biggest thing, didn't cost anything to add Dinwiddie. So it feels like a plus for LA. The self-creation, the playmaking, the size, I think will help the Lakers. The lineup versatility is what I'm keeping an eye on. We've seen Dinwiddie be able to play next to Russell. So what are those two-guard lineup, three-guard lineups look for? This has helped them get closer to the vision of, hey, we have playmakers. We don't have to lean on LeBron to a certain degree. How does that kind of work? If the shot returns to form, I think that's a big win for the Lakers. But I don't necessarily see it as a negative. I know some folks may look at defense and think that might be, hey, the need. I don't necessarily know if defense is going to, I don't know, A, if you could find that defender right away. And B, if you can clean up the offense and you have lineups with this amount of size, does that have value for you come playoff season? And can you have some more fun with some of the smaller lineups you could run in theory in the postseason? So I think it's a plus. It's going to be highly motivated.
Yeah, that was going to be the first thing I say. He should be highly motivated, which Net fans kind of bemoan, like, the decrease in drives for Spencer Dinwiddie over this recent stretch. I would imagine he finds the turbo button a little bit more now that he's going to be in L.A. And if he's coming off the bench and playing against second units, it should be a little bit easier for him to get downhill anyway with some of the matchups he may see. That portion should help. The Lakers quietly playing faster this year, I feel like it's just been an under-discussed portion of the program for their season. Him being able to just play in the open floor a little bit more should make life easier for him. Should be able to get downhill more. Maybe that at least to more comfort as he gets into some of the pull-ups and some of the step-backs there. You mentioned the potential lineups they can get to. That should be a lot of fun. I am keeping eyes on the defense, but at the very least, the Lakers can really size up in a way that most teams can't. And so even if you are worried about him, if you have LeBron on the back line and Anthony Davis also on the back line, and if the help is keyed in with some of the guys they can have in, if he's playing with Torian Prince, if he's still at the three, or Rui, even if he gets beat off the drive, like, those openings won't be the same as they were in, like, Brooklyn, which is just generally a smaller team than the Lakers. That should help. I think beyond that, though, I guess actually I'll ask you this. How often do you think we see, like, Dinwiddie plus bench period units versus him and D'Lo together, or him kind of staggered with LeBron and playing off of him? Do you see any scenario in which it's him plus bench and kind of lead it that way, and the Lakers can rest all their guys at once? Or do you think that'd be too much responsibility on them?
I mean, I'd probably lean, if that's the question, more towards it's a possibility. I mean, I was just watching Skylar Mays, Jackson Hayes, and Christian Wood doing work the other day.
I was about to say, hey, not too much on fan favorite Skylar Mays.
I think there's an opportunity for them to go ahead and do that. I don't think it'd be too much responsibility. He has the experience.
Okay, just figure that out. Other signings, if you go back to the East, we talked about campaign and them needing some of the pick and roll usage, some of the scoring in particular. Kyle Lowry, he's going home. He's going home, tell the world, etc. The Sixers signing Kyle Lowry to a rest of season deal on the year in Miami. 8.2 points per game, 51% on twos, but super low volume there. 39% from three, 83% from the line, also not getting there all that often. 3.5 boards, 4 assists, and over a steal in 28 minutes per game, which is his lowest since becoming a full-time starter a long time ago. Steve, how do you foresee the fit for Lowry in Philadelphia?
I mean, he's going home, return with Nick Nurse. I think that's going to be a plus as far as being able to make sure the second unit is running properly and trying to make sure they get quality shots. The context is going to be interesting. I feel like he did a lot of positive things for Miami, but it reached the point of, hey, you need to make shots. What does that look like if and when Joel Embiid comes back? Like, I have more questions in the back of my head now because I think he can help this team. How much does he help this team right now? That's where I'm kind of stuck. How do you feel about it?
Well, first and foremost, aside from the homecoming, assuming Embiid is back later this year, easily the best entry passer he's played with. That alone should be helpful for Joel Embiid, should be helpful from Kyle Lowry. But beyond that, though, like, I think the aggression point is a sound one. It doesn't help you knock down shots if you are turning them down. And so he's going to have the right level of aggression. But honestly, one of the questions I had was, like, when he's playing alongside Tyrese Maxey, because I'm sure there'll be some minutes there, even before Embiid gets back. We'll see those two on the floor together. Like, what kind of value will he provide playing off of Maxey? Obviously, there's going to be, like, the early initiation. He can run stuff and then kick it to Maxey's second side. But if it is Maxey bringing it up, again, what kind of aggression will he showcase? Because you don't want Lowry to get to the point in Philly to where, yeah, we know you can shoot. We don't know if you will. We're going to provide this extra layer of help to make sure Tyrese Maxey can't get all the way downhill. And if Lowry isn't able to punish that with shots or get all the way downhill when he does drive, and drives were down to Miami this year, then there is the possibility of that impact being a bit muted for him offensively. Defensively, he's still going to work hard. He's still going to draw charges. He's still going to be pesky off the ball. There are some guys that he just cannot guard at this stage anymore. And again, if we're talking about potential Lowry plus Maxey lineups, that is a small backcourt. So I do, honestly, I wonder with him being back with Nick Nurse, like, are they more willing to switch with him in Philly? And what does that look like? Like, do we see any kind of crossover there between, like, how he's used defensively in Miami to how he's being used in Philly, even if he just has his own rules? Like, we'll switch the off-ball stuff with Kyle. Tyrese, we need you to navigate and stuff like that. Like, I want to see what kind of nuance is going to be there for Lowry. But overall, like, very smart player on both ends of the floor. When he has it going, he can knock down pull-ups and spot-ups. Really good reader of space. So, like, it should be a positive impact overall. I don't know how much this will swing, like, the true championship odds. Again, the biggest swinger of that will be Embiid and his health. But he should help. We'll see what the lineups are going to look like from there. Going back out west, the Thunder signing Bismack Biyombo, which, you know, they don't trade for a center, and then they just sign one. So that's pretty cool. I guess they help with that portion. Anyway, Bismack in Memphis, 5.6 boards, a career high, 1.7 assists, if you care about that portion. 1.1 blocks per game, 56% on twos there. How are we liking the Bismack fit in OKC?
There's your big who can rebound, right?
You did it.
That's what everyone's asking for.
You did dump some. Like, very obvious depth piece there. Someone that can crash the offensive glass. A really, really good screener. We should aid those guards whenever he's out there. Quality defender, scheme versatile. By all accounts, a really good locker room guy. And I think, honestly, if you're going to add a big in the free agent market, if you're OKC, like, this is the type you want. Someone that can give you something different. Can give you a little bit of size. He's still, what, 6'9"? So still not a massive hunking like Steven Adams type center. But a little bit more size. Battle-tested veteran. Also someone that knows, okay, I may not play tonight. And that's okay. I can still help these guys. So you're adding a different center option that can give you something that you may be lacking, as he's still a good rebounder, without you are guaranteed to play over Jalen. You are now, there are no more Kendricks at five lineups. Honestly, do you think we see whenever he is in the rotation. Do you think we see him and Chet together at all?
I wouldn't put it past him. I mean, technically, they played Chet and Jalen Williams together at points.
Yeah.
So I don't know how much they would do it. I do believe he's like an extra body to help in case they need that. So I don't have too high, I don't have too many expectations on it.
Gotcha, gotcha. And then very quickly, per the Patrick Beverly pod, the Pat Bell pod, Marcus Morris leaning towards signing with the Minnesota Timberwolves, averaging 6.7 points per game this year, shade under 3 rebounds in 17 minutes. He is shooting 40% from 3 this year, 11 points and 4 boards, while shooting 42% from 3 in 7 starts this season. You know what time it is. It is a, can I just say,
you was complaining about the offense.
This is peak. That's not what I meant. Or hashtag not like that, though. So, like, on one hand, Marcus Morris will single-handedly limit your turnover rate. On the other hand, is that really the, like, jokes aside, this is a fit that strikes me as odd. Still a talented offensive player. But I just think about the broader context of Rudy's playing a lot of minutes. Cat's playing a lot of minutes. Nas Reed's going to play a good bit of minutes. Like, is this just the, okay, Kyle Anderson, you have not turned this around offensively as a scorer at all. Let's get a spacier option out here. Like, is that what this would be if the signing actually happens? Because, again, it's leaning towards. It hasn't been made official yet. At least as of recording, it hasn't been. Like, is this more like Kyle Anderson insurance, or do you see a bigger role for Marcus if he goes to Minnesota?
It feels like, can we not play these guys so many minutes? / can we boost some of our bench scoring? / can we not need Kyle Anderson to do both of those things? And especially if you consider that they added Monte Morris, so technically some of the playmaking, if you go quote-unquote pure bench, should slide from Kyle to Monte. Well, we're probably going to need some spacing around that. So, hey, Marcus Morris, you know what time it is.
It will indeed be Marcus Morris time, as it tends to be. All right, rapid fire to close this out as we're getting short on time. The Pistons waving Danilo Gallinari after all of their deadline stuff. They had to get the roster in order in terms of the spots there. So Danilo Gallinari hitting waivers, averaging 7.3 points and 3 boards in 15 minutes, shooting 55% on twos, 36% from three, quiet as kept. Is there a potential landing spot that you like for Danilo?
No.
Is this just Miami?
No, you.
Okay. I was about to say, Miami was the first thought. And, like, I would get it, but, like, also, I feel like it, especially in light of all the Miami injuries, which I guess I can just blend that in now, Jimmy Butler dealing with some personal issues. He's going to be out through All-Star break. Josh Richardson dislocated his right shoulder against Boston. He's going to be reevaluated in a few weeks. Terry Rozier also suffered a knee injury during that Boston game. The MRI, again, as we record on a Monday afternoon, the MRI is supposed to happen today. And so I guess hopefully by the time the pod drops on Tuesday, Tuesdays for the Dunkers, we should have more information there. So that'll just be an update on the next pod. If so, Miami's going to need some semblance of depth in the front court. So I guess Gallo would technically count. But I would imagine they would still want some more wing help in particular. So I don't know. But like Gallo seems like a very natural, hey, we got the Kevin Love resurgence. You can pick and pop. You can punish mismatches on the block. We can just zone it up. If all else fails, let's find some minutes for you, help the shooting and stuff. Beyond that, I don't know.
But Phoenix.
I don't know. You could. Be another, I guess even that, is that just like Drew Eubanks erasure at that point? We appreciate you, big dog, but also we just want space at the five now.
What about Boston?
Again. That'd be a good tip. And then to close it out, on the NBA side, quick shout-outs to Gigi Jackson getting a 4-year deal. And what a rookie season it's been for him. Shout-out to Keon Ellis for getting a standard deal, a 3-year deal in Sacramento. On the W side, Kennedy Carter and Kaiser Gondrzik both getting training cap contracts. The Aces signed Bria Hartley to a training camp contract. and was announced per release earlier today, the Dallas Wings signing in Cannon, who's with the Indiana Fever last year. I'm not sure as of right now if that's a training camp deal or a standard deal for her, in which case, boy, do the Wings have some roster decisions to make before the season starts, because that feels very full and also very front court heavy. So we will see what happens on that front. Any of those announcements / signings pop for you before we close?
I'm waiting for you to jump on the Chicago SkyTrain. June 13th comes soon.
I see.
Also, before you hit the outro, I have to hit the segment. Also, if you're watching on YouTube, like, subscribe, comment your favorite trade debut. Two thumbs up. Things that Nekias missed. Shams says New Orleans Pelicans guard Dyson Daniels has suffered a meniscus tear in his left knee, is sidelined indefinitely. The NBA has said the Dallas Mavericks guard Luka Doncic and Cleveland Cavaliers guard Donovan Mitchell have been named the NBA Western and Eastern Conference Players of the Week.
Oh, okay. Well, shout out to Luka. Shout out to Donovan Mitchell. That really stinks for Dyson, who's been really fun defensively, offensively. We don't want to talk about it. We ain't got time. Hope Dyson is okay, though. Should open up some room for Jose Alvarado. Maybe more Jordan Hawkins. They have other guards and perimeter players to play while Dyson's out. Dang, that sucks, though. That really sucks. I hope Dyson's all right. And to very quickly to your Sky point. Again, the players may be cool. The organizational decisions over the last year and a half, I don't know if I'm going to have less smoke for them. But, you know, if Kennedy is able to be consistent both on and off the floor, that's a signing that could pop for Chicago. Ridiculous driver, very good score. We'll see where the three ball lands, but she can get a bucket. So I'm curious to see what happens there. And then to shout out to Kaiser, hope she's doing well. And we'll see if both or either of them make the final roster. So we'll keep tabs on that. Beyond that, thank you for listening to and or watching this episode of The Dunker Spot. If you haven't already, please subscribe to us. We are on Apple, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. And if you're watching this on JJ Ray's YouTube channel and for some reason you haven't subscribed to the YouTube channel, please subscribe to the YouTube channel. We are here every Tuesday. And in general, lots of great content between us and JJ dropping on the channel all throughout the week. So rock with us. You can follow me on Twitter at NekiasNBA. You can follow Steve on Twitter at SteveJones20. Join the Dunker Spot community on Twitter. We're having fun talks in there. Join us for our online Dunker Spot watch parties. If you have a League Pass subscription, you can watch basketball games with us live. Real-time analysis during commercial breaks. We're going over plays that might have stood out. At the end of games, Steve is breaking down why a late fourth quarter or overtime play did or didn't work. And in general, it's a very fun place to be. You can hop on stage with us, ask us basketball questions, or if you want to vent about your job, life, etc., and just want to let your hair down a bit, you can do that as well. We sprinkle in like TikTok Fridays sometimes, random weeks. So if you want to just laugh for like an hour and a half, 2 hours, we also just sprinkle that stuff in. It's a good place to be. Link is in the description. Come rock with us if you're there. And with that, we will catch y'all later in the week.
Great show, Nekias. Sorry that I'm congested. But did you know that he meant boots and a fur coat, not like just boots with fur?